Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Okay, I get to do the gavel.
Can I go now, George?
Yes,
okay.
Woo, that was a new high for me. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. And you can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org, on Facebook and Twitter, and on the club's YouTube channel. They are so social media savvy. I am Cheryl Jennings, reporter for ABC 7 in San Francisco, and I'm your moderator for this evening. Tonight's program is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It is now my great pleasure and honor to introduce today's distinguished guest, Jackie Speer, the U.S. Representative for California's District 14 and author of the new memoir, Undaunted, Surviving Jonestown, Summoning Courage, and Fighting Back. Welcome.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you all.
Jackie Speer was 28 when she joined Congressman Leo Ryan's delegation to rescue defectors from cult leader Jim Jones' People's Temple in Jonestown, Guyana. Now, Congressman Ryan, tragically, was killed on the airstrip tarmac. Ms. Speer was shot 5 times at point-blank range. While recovering from what would become one of the most harrowing tragedies in recent history, she had to choose. Would she become a victim or a fighter? The choice to survive against unfathomable odds empowered her with a resolve to become a vocal proponent for human rights. Now, cut to 2018. Congresswoman Jackie Speer is a tireless advocate for women's rights, strong oversight to weed out corruption, and national and economic security. She was named to Newsweek's list of 150 fearless women in the world, and Politico's 50 most influential people in American politics for bringing the Me Too reckoning to Congress. She serves on the House Armed Services Committee as the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Military Personnel and on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. She is also co-chair of the Bipartisan Task Force to End Sexual Violence. Jackie Speer's new memoir, Undaunted, reveals the perseverance of a determined force in American politics, deeply rooted in her experience as a widow, a mother, a congresswoman, and a fighter. Hers is a story of true resilience, no matter what the challenges. So please give a warm welcome to Congresswoman Jackie Speer.
Thank you.
I read your book twice.
Twice.
Okay. I was really so impressed with just, and we'd known each other for many years, but the things that you revealed were, some of them were just obviously tragic, sad, and very funny. Well, so we'll get to the funny part in a little while, but we have to talk about the obvious story. And remember, this is 40 years ago, so there are a lot of young people in our audience who would not even know this story, the shooting in Jonestown and the fact that you were shot and left for dead 40 years ago. So for those who don't know this story at all, why were you in Jonestown? What was the purpose of that?
So Congressman Ryan was what I call an experiential legislator. He didn't take people's word for anything. He wanted to find out for himself. So early in his career, after the Watts riots, he went down to South Central LA and taught as a substitute teacher. He was a teacher by profession. He had himself incarcerated at Folsom Prison to look at the criminal justice system and spent 10 days there. He then decided that he wanted to go to Guyana himself, to the People's Temple, to find out whether or not American citizens were being held against their will.
And for people who don't know what People's Temple is, it was a cult.
So the People's Temple was a church led by the Reverend Jim Jones. It's a church here in San Francisco, one in L.A., many congregants, some 2,000 of them here in the San Francisco Bay Area. Many of them were young adults, and they had been kind of captured by his commitment to bringing African Americans and whites together and living in a socialist kind of environment, pooling your resources. And so it was under those circumstances that many of the congressmen's parents of these young people had contacted him, concerned about their well-being. And then there were defectors of the People's Temple. Those who had been part of the People's Temple had been beaten up emotionally, physically, sexually, who had left and come out and told their story. So it was on the heels of all of that, coupled with the fact that Marshall Kilduff at the San Francisco Chronicle did an investigative piece on Jim Jones that was not at all flattering. The San Francisco Chronicle was loath to print it, so he took it to New West Magazine, and it was published there. Before it was published, Jim Jones decided he was going to get out of town, and that's when he took 900 of his followers to Georgetown, Guyana, and then subsequently to Jonestown. He had been building this commune for a couple of years before the large contingent went down there. But what was really sad about it was that he had so ingratiated himself to the political powers that be here in the city that they all looked the other way. So even when the complaints started to spread, law enforcement, city officials took no action.
But one of the reasons they took no action was he was very good at getting out the vote.
That's correct. At a moment's notice, he could create a crowd for a rally. If you needed precinct walking, he would release all of his members of his congregation to go out and walk precincts. And he was credited with helping then-Mayor George Moscone, who was being recalled at the time, from repelling that recall.
So he was quite powerful. He had influence.
And he wanted to be appointed to something significant within the administration. And he was offered a position as the Human Relations Commission. He was not interested in that. And he parlayed it so that he could become the chair of the Housing Authority in San Francisco. And then he would always have a number of his followers in the audience at the meetings and applaud every time he said anything. So it was...
So you stacked the audience.
Yeah. There was a bit of a bizarre nature then. So with that backdrop, that's why Congressman Ryan went to Jonestown.
When you decided... when he made that decision, you really didn't want him to go. You had a bad feeling about it.
I did, because I had been listening to all these audio tapes of interviews that had been done by the district staff with some of the defectors. And there were families and there were young people. And it didn't sound good. I mean, if you're talking about physical abuse, sexual abuse, armed guards, shooting planes out of the sky, I mean, it's unnerving. So I was in the process of buying a condominium in Arlington, Virginia, and I literally had written into the contract that it was null and void unless I survived the trip to Jonestown.
You also wrote a note to your mom and dad.
I did. It's in the book, and I actually did not uncover that until I was at the end of the book, when I was asked by my editor to come up with some pictures. So there's a tub of papers in my garage from my parents' home. I thought, well, maybe I'll look through there. Mm-hmm. And I looked through there, and there was this letter, this little note that I had written them, in which I said that I was very happy with the love that I had. My life was complete. And then at the bottom, because I was raised by very frugal parents, I indicated that I had a $1,000 life insurance policy with the credit union.
It's very practical, right? Just in case. That's amazing. Yeah, you'll see the original, a copy of the original note in the book. So you get there, and was it tense at first? Or was it, how was it when you got there?
So it's a jungle, so it's, you know, very deep jungle environment. But all of a sudden, you know, you're in a dump truck arriving there on this dirt road, and you see corn growing in the fields. So they had agriculturally committed the land to mm-hmm. provide them some produce. And you see the sign that says Agricultural Project, Jonestown. We get to the pavilion area, and Jim Jones is there with his wife, Marceline, and all a group of people, most of the hierarchy of the People's mm-hmm. Temple. Ironically, it was run like a plantation. The whites were in the leadership, and mm-hmm. the African Americans were part of the general community. So they took us on a tour, and we toured the cabins and the preschool and the medical clinic, and you couldn't help but be impressed that they had carved out a livelihood in the middle of this jungle. So at the end of that, we sat down on a picnic table in the back of the pavilion and started requesting certain members to come to visit with us. And I had a manila envelope filled with letters from parents here in the Bay Area that they wanted us to hand deliver to their children, because young adult children, because they thought that somehow their mail wasn't getting through.
And were you allowed to speak to them and deliver them?
Yes. So we started meeting with many of these young people, and it was really eerie because they all said the same thing. They all said, I'm very happy here. No, I'm not interested in going home. No, I'm not interested in connecting with my parents. And I'm about to get married to a fellow member of the People's Temple. That was kind of the line, the script that many of them would give us.
At any point, did people hand you notes or part of your delegation, the media who were with you?
So towards the end of the evening, they had performed dance and sang songs and played music. Congressman Ryan got up, and you might have seen that clip on TV. He says, well, it looks like from all I can see here, you're all very happy. And the place erupted in applause. And it was odd because it just kept going on. There was a frenetic nature to it. And he sort of laughed and then came back to the back of the pavilion. Don Harris was the NBC reporter who was on the trip. And he had been walking around the outside of the perimeter of the pavilion, and someone came up and slipped him a note. And the note had two names on it of people who wanted to leave. And so he comes over to us and hands us this note, and my heart sunk because I just knew that everything that we had feared was true, mm-hmm. that people were being held against their will. And so then the next plan was, how do we make sure they get out? So that night I was taken to a cabin with some women, and I was on the top bunk, and they had tin roofs, and it was raining. And it was this peppering of noise that kept me awake all night. And I kept thinking, what are we going to do? And how are we going to get out of here? And how do we do it as calmly as possible? So the next morning, I helped one of the defectors get her belongings. But there was a guard standing at her cabin, not wanting to let us in. He didn't have a gun that was noticeable, but he was trying to intimidate her. And we got our belongings, came back to the pavilion, and then more and more people wanted to leave. And then a whole family wanted to leave. And so then it got very tense.
Mm. And then you did try to take these people with you, and people started boarding the plane.
So we then took, we had a dump truck full of defectors who wanted to leave. Congressman Ryan was staying behind with another 40 defectors. And then there was a knifing attempt on him. So they brought him down to the...
One of the people who pretended to defect.
Well, he was still up at the pavilion, but it was one of the members of the temple. And so he was brought down and got into the truck, and we went to the airstrip. Unbeknownst to us was a tractor trailer following behind us with gunmen on it. So I am putting passengers onto the two planes. I'm very leery of this one defector who was one of the members of the hierarchy, Larry Layton, who had been very critical of his sister who had been a defector and maligned her and was saying how great it was. And all of a sudden he's on the truck leaving because he was, quote, a defector. So he had this yellow poncho on, and I asked one of the reporters to frisk him. And he did, evidently not well enough. And then I wanted to make sure he wasn't on the same plane. So I put him on the smaller plane. And I'm turning around and starting to load the passengers onto the larger plane. And there's this little Guyanese child scurrying into the plane. We didn't have enough seats, so I'm trying to coax him out of the plane. And then the sound of gunfire erupts. Now, I didn't know it was gunfire at first. I turned around. Congressman Ryan had been shot. And then he was shot a second time and fell. And then I ran under the plane and hid under a wheel. And then over the course of the next few minutes, I played dead with my right side of my body, you know, exposed and my head down. So I was lying on my left side. And then all of a sudden I got hit. And I turned and looked at myself, and I had a bone in my right arm coming up through the skin. My whole right leg was blown up. And I thought I was dying.
You were hit 5 times. And you still have some of that in your body.
2 bullets. Little souvenirs.
Wow. So you played dead. The gunfire eventually stopped. And then what happened?
So I thought I was dying. And you know, I'm 28. I'm thinking, oh, my God, this is it. I'm not going to have the life I had planned for myself. And I said the act of contrition because I was raised a good Catholic girl. And then waited for the lights to go out. And then when I was still alive, I thought, oh, my grandmother, I don't want her to have to live through my funeral. She was 87 at the time. So I somehow dragged my body from this position to the plane because the engines were still revving. Mm. And someone came from behind me and said, hurry up, Jackie, hurry up. And I'm thinking, I can't move. And he shoved me into the cargo hold. And it was, I was there for some period of time, and then I was taken out and placed on the side of the airstrip on an anthill. Believe it or not, you don't sweat the small stuff when you're dying, however. So eventually I was placed in a tent with 3 other more seriously wounded people, and we spent the night there. And I got through that night because Bob Flick, who was the NBC producer, came from this little town that was near the airstrip where everyone had gone to hide out. And it was a bar, and he brought me some Guyanese rum and gave me swigs of Guyanese rum.
That's how you killed the pain.
That's how I killed
the
pain.
Oh, my gosh. And then it's just complete chaos. The congressman is dead. You couldn't even process what had happened to everyone else. You were just dealing with your own impending sense of, I'm going to die.
Right. I mean, there was a sense that they would come back and finish us off.
Right.
And
how did they not do that? Did somebody set up guards, or did they just leave?
Well, they left and went back to Jonestown, and then the White Knight trials that everyone had talked about, where Jim Jones would wake people up in the middle of the night over the loudspeaker and say, come to the pavilion, and they would go there, and then he'd make them drink something, and he was testing their loyalty. Well, this time it wasn't a test. It was for real. And there was cyanide-laced Kool-Aid.
For 900 people.
For 900 people. And you either drank it or it was injected into your arm.
And they had had drills for this.
Right.
Where the beverage was not. People keep calling it the Kool-Aid, but it was just some sort of beverage that they drank. And then the children and the infants.
Over 300 of them were children and infants.
But they were injected.
Right.
So they were injected with the cyanide. And we have images. I don't even know how you can get through this story, because every time I hear it, it just hurts my heart. You see syringes all over the place and these big vats of this liquid. And this time around, the drill was not a drill.
It wasn't a drill.
Did you know that at the time when you were...
No. In fact, you know, this is 1978. There were no cell phones. It's a jungle environment. But somehow, through the night, word came that they had done the White Knight.
And that's what they called it, the White Knight.
Yeah, the White Knight trials. So we didn't, of course, know what had gone on. I mean, the visuals that you see on TV are ghastly. And they're kind of burned in my memory of all those bodies lying there face down in these colorful T-shirts.
Did you witness that yourself, or you were just in such a bad state physically? No.
It was some 7 miles away, too. So.
And then help finally arrived.
So about 22 hours after the shooting.
22 hours with only rum, and I think somebody gave you a couple of aspirin.
A couple of aspirin. At 5 a.m. in the morning, the Guyanese army came by train to secure the airstrip, and there was a medic. I thought, oh, I'm going to get my medical attention. I'll put this in a cast, and I'll be on my way. He comes into the tent. He looks at me. I have this tarp over my body, and he hands me 2 aspirin. Literally, that's what he did. So I took one, and I saved one for when the pain got really bad.
Oh my gosh.
So when they were actually lifting me up to the plane that was going to take me back to Georgetown, I saw that aspirin that I had left unused. And then we were taken by plane to the Capitol, where there was a U.S. medevac plane waiting.
When you saw that plane, what did you think? That American plane?
I mean, I saw it again this morning when they were taking President Bush's body to Washington. And it's, you know, this big white plane with the words United States of America written across it. And it was like someone had just wrapped me in the American flag. And there's never a time that I say the Pledge of Allegiance or sing the national anthem that I don't go back to that moment, because I feel so lucky to be alive. And we all are lucky to be American citizens.
Mm-hmm. The recovery from all of that, I mean, your body was heavily damaged, and it took you a long time to recover. Like, you even wound up doing what, hyperbaric oxygen to heal those wounds?
Well, they thought they were going to have to amputate my arm and or my leg. Because I had gas gangrene through my system. So they then took me to Baltimore Shock Trauma, where I had the hyperbaric chamber treatments.
So it was months and months of recovery.
Months and months in the hospital, and then months and months later of recovery.
So that was one thing that happened to
you. Yes.
Incredible. I know that has shaped your career, but there are other things as well, one of which I'm reluctant to talk about, but you put it in your book, and we did talk privately about it, and then talked publicly about it, and this is something that happened in her childhood, and I'm hoping that you're comfortable telling us about what happened when you were a little girl.
So when I was a little girl, my parents would sometimes take me over to my grandparents on the weekend, because they were building a little weekend place in Boys Hot Springs. And I would stay with my grandparents. And my grandfather would take a nap with me in the afternoon, and we'd be under this wonderful green silk goose down comforter. And he molested me. And I was too young to understand much, but it didn't seem right. And I don't even know how many times it happened, 4, 5, 6 times. I eventually told my mom, who was horrified. I don't know if she ever told my father.
Did she ever say anything to you?
I could just tell by the pain in her face.
So she didn't verbally acknowledge you.
And I suppressed it. I basically just compartmentalized it and went on with life. And then when I was writing the book, I was trying to understand why I had such a passion, such a fire about issues around statute of limitations on rape, sexual assault in the military, sexual assault on college campuses. And then it all clicked, and I realized it probably had a lot to do with having been abused by my grandfather when I was a child. And I wasn't going to put it in the book at first, but then I thought, you know, this is an issue that plagues more families than we know.
And nobody wants to talk about it.
And it's important to talk about it and show that you can overcome these horrible things that happen to you.
You talked about the shame when you were a child. You had to tell your mom your shame. And that's part of the problem with child abuse victims, mm-hmm. is they feel like somehow or another it was their fault.
Right. What did I do?
Yeah.
Why did this happen?
Mm-hmm.
And I was young, so it was hard to... It was hard to know if this was right or wrong, but it didn't feel right.
You didn't have the language for it or understanding. And so you put that away, and you rose from that. You survived Guyana. What was that like to tell your family, your children, about the molestation?
You know, I didn't talk about it. I was like this absolutely vigilant parent with my kids. And when I was a single parent, of course, there would be, you know, friends who would want to take the kids and do things with them. And I was always very super vigilant. And I just was very clear, you don't let anyone ever touch you, ever.
Yeah. Speaking of children, you were trying so desperately to have a second child after your firstborn son, and you suffered miscarriages. So adding to the things that Jackie has had to overcome.
Well,
I'm not trying to make light of it because I know it was a terrible time for you.
Well, you know, many women have miscarriages, but I think we forget that it's still a loss. And I remember my darling aunt who I beloved, who was beloved, and she said to me, oh, well, you could have another one. And it was so like, what do you mean? I just lost a child. So we're not good in our society of coming up with how to appreciate someone's pain and help them live through it without trying to make light of it sometimes. That part was difficult. The real hard part, of course, was the second miscarriage because it was at 17 weeks and I was much farther along in the pregnancy. And to lose that fetus was very painful.
Mm. When you finally did get pregnant...
But then there was a failed adoption in there, too.
Yes. A little one whom you had for just a few weeks.
Yeah, 10 days, actually. And then the birth mother wanted to take the baby back. And so I'm coming back from Sacramento just sobbing. And I called my husband, Steve, and I said, honey, why do these bad things keep happening to us? And he said, now, wait a minute. We have each other, we have our son, we have our health, and we can try to have another baby. So we go to the fertility specialist who says so elegantly, based on the age of your eggs and your medical history, you have a 10% chance of getting pregnant with in vitro fertilization. So those odds weren't very good. It was an expensive procedure that health insurance didn't cover at the time. And so we thought, you know what? This is a sign. We're going to close this chapter. We have this wonderful young son, and we're going to move on with life.
But then you got pregnant.
So then...
It was a miracle.
It was a miracle.
You deserved a miracle. You deserved a miracle after all of that.
And we just talked to my miracle daughter a few minutes ago, didn't we?
We FaceTimed with...
But it was kind of... I mean, it was so ridiculous that I wouldn't even go and get the pregnancy test that you normally get, which I had used 100 times before. But at 11 o'clock at night one night, I went to Walgreens, picked up the pregnancy test, took it. Said, oh my God, I turned the right color for the first time. I called my husband, who was an ER doc at the county hospital. I said, honey, I think I'm pregnant. He says, what was it, immaculate conception? So he says, come down to the hospital. Let's get a blood test. And so I did. And then he called me at 7 a.m. and says, you know what? You are pregnant. Naturally. It's divine intervention.
It was, absolutely. And sadly, with this miracle, something else tragic happened to your wonderful husband, Stephen.
So I was driving to Sacramento to give a speech to the California Bankers Association. I got a call from my secretary who said, Steve's been in an automobile accident. We just got a call from San Mateo Police. And so I was with my district director. We turned around. It was torrential rain. We drove back, got to the hospital, waited and waited. Finally, they let me see Steve. He was in the ICU, and he was brain dead.
Hmm. And you're how far along in your pregnancy?
I was about 3 months pregnant at the time.
That was the very lowest point in your life.
It was. I couldn't think. And I remember going to my son's school. He was in kindergarten. And picking him up and bringing him to the hospital to say goodbye to his dad. And he kissed him goodbye. And he said, Mommy, can I go to karate now? And I said, of course. You know, but having to give the instructions to unplug the respirator was probably the toughest thing I've ever done.
And all this time, you're still working or trying to work. In your book, you said that you prayed a lot, that your faith powered your belief that if you could just get out of bed, if you could manage that forward movement, you could handle the circumstances of the day.
And some days I didn't get out of bed. I mean, I think when tough things happen to us, we have to give ourselves the space to say, you know, okay, today you can stay in bed.
Mm-hmm.
Just promise you'll get up tomorrow. And that's how I coped.
But you're still working or trying to work
point. Well, it was also a high-risk pregnancy, so I was on bed rest for part of that time.
And knowing you, you're probably working from home.
I was.
Yes.
Negotiating the lemon law, as a matter of fact, from home.
How important was friendship during this time, your female friends?
Huge, huge. I don't think life is worth living if you can't have friends in your life. I think that's the biggest gift you can give yourself. It requires effort and energy, but they were there for me in so many ways and have continued to be there for me. So I'm blessed. I'm incredibly blessed.
It was kind of a mixed sense of your gallows humor in the book, because a lot of the women who were your friends became widows themselves, and you had a name for them.
We called it the Merry Widows Club that nobody wanted to join. And it was part of, I mean, what you learn when you go through widowhood, that there's someone there for you, and then it's important for you to pay it forward. And there was a woman friend of mine in Sacramento who, when she heard that Steve had died in a car crash in that torrential rain, drove down from Sacramento to come and just, you know, give me a hug and be there. So subsequently, Janya Najero, who was an acquaintance more than a friend.
She was a very prominent broadcaster for many years in the Bay Area.
Her husband was diagnosed with a glioblastoma and then died. And so I paid it forward, took her under my wing. And then we created this club. So we are now 12 members. We still get together 3 or 4 times a year and support each other.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
I want to talk a little bit about your legislative work.
I remember a story you told me a long time ago about, you know, people see you and you look so successful and you've got it all, but just trying to become a lawmaker was a nightmare for you. And putting aside the personal trauma, you're still trying to work, you're still trying to become that person who can serve the public. You kept trying and trying and trying to get the job.
So I was not successful in my bids for office from time to time. In fact, it started when I was in high school and I lost for student body president. I stayed
good
home
practice,
from school
though.
For 2 days. I was so humiliated.
Oh.
My mother actually let me stay home, but she was not one for that kind of thing. But anyway, and then I ran for Leo Ryan's seat and lost. And then ran for Lieutenant Governor of California in 2006 and lost again. But what I learned at each of those losses was how you only win by losing. I mean, losing the Lieutenant Governor's race was very tough, particularly since, I mean, we didn't know till 2 or 3 in the a.m. in the morning, and then I had to get up at 8 a.m. that morning and go to my son's high school graduation. And then I had to just, you know, buck up and say, this is about your son. This is about his success and happiness. And you've just got to meet all those parents and just look really happy.
Are they coming up consoling you because you lost?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Like, it was a blur, right?
But anyway, it was... So losing is part of winning, really.
We know that Congress doesn't have as many women as some of us would like to have.
But we have a whole lot more than we did 2 months ago. I don't call it the blue wave, I call it the pink wave. So there are 35 new women members in the House of Representatives. 34 of them are Democrats. 22 of them have never run for public office before. So it's a great example of how if you have the fire in your belly, if you have a message, there's no formula for getting elected to any office, and not one to get elected to Congress either.
I wonder if they will have to deal with the sort of harassment that you had to deal with and that other members of Congress have had to deal with who are females. You had a story in the book about that.
So when I was a staffer, the chief of staff one night when we were in the office pushed me up against the wall and kissed me and stuck his tongue in my mouth, and I just kind of recoiled. And there was no term of sexual harassment then. This was, you know, in the early, mid-70s. And I just made sure I was never going to be alone with him again. But I told the story in a video because I wanted the women on the Hill to know they had someone they could talk to. And so when the Me Too movement kicked up, I started getting women coming to tell me about just gross experiences they had had with members of Congress. And I had worked on this issue before, both in the state legislature and in Congress, to no success. But I thought this was an opportunity that I was not going to let slip by. And so we created a training for members and staff, a yearly training that they now all have to go through. It was fun attending my first one and having all these members squirm in their seats, but asking very legitimate questions and probing questions. So that's all very good. And now we're trying to reform the system so that victims are treated with respect, that they're not subject to these non-disclosure agreements or mandatory mediation or cooling off periods. We're trying to transform that whole process so that they are protected, they're represented by counsel, and that the members are held responsible for their conduct by having the responsibility to repay the federal government for any settlement. So
I don't think people realize that what happens. Who pays when a congressman?
So the way the system has worked up till now is the congressman was never identified. The settlement was made, and the taxpayers picked up the tab.
To thousands.
So the behavior was never really diminished because it was a get-out-of-jail-free pass for all intents and purposes. So now what will happen is they have to repay the settlement within 90 days, or if they don't have the resources, then we will start garnishing their wages, and if that's not enough, their thrift savings plan, and if that's not enough, their Social Security.
Wow.
It's really serious.
How do they get to keep their jobs, though?
Because well, what's happened to most of them is the heat gets so bad that they resign. But I think the fact that you would have to be responsible for repaying it is going to be the most sanitizing thing we can do in order to prevent the conduct. And victims now know what their rights and how they can access services too, which before no one even knew the Office of Congressional Compliance existed.
And now they do, thanks to you.
They sure do now.
One of the issues you and I have been working on for the last few years is rape in the military, men and women who are assaulted, sexually assaulted by their own in services, which is, and we've talked, you have helped these people get help, treatment, and help them resolve their cases. Can you talk a little bit about what happens to them when they make a claim now? Nobody believes them.
Right. And it's still a very imperfect system because all of these cases go up the chain of command. And there is a special military code that is different from our civilian code. So the Uniform Code of Military Justice allows these persons who are convening authorities, their commanders, to make a decision. Do you give non-judicial punishment? Do you not give any punishment at all? Or do you seek a court-martial? But there's a conflict of interest. There's an embedded conflict of interest. Either they are the abuser, or they're the best friend of the abuser, or they're about to get a promotion, and they are concerned that this is going to reflect poorly on them, that their rape went on under their command. So there are about 20,000 cases a year. They're mostly men, I might add.
20,000 cases.
And only about 5,000 report, because the fear of reporting, retaliation, being ostracized is so great that they don't. So the behavior continues. And it's really all about power. It's not so much about sex. It's about power and imposing your power on others. But there have been just egregious situations at Lackland Air Force Base. 36 military training instructors who had sex with over 60 trainees, and not one of the trainees came forward. Not one. It finally was reported by other military training officers who were sick of seeing it. And it took three of them before the Air Force took it seriously.
You want to take it out of the chain of command.
I want to take it out of the chain of command. It is like, you know, it's like one of those gospels that they just can't get, can't understand how that could possibly happen, because it would undermine their authority. So we're still working on it. The one good news I have to report is that we've had lots of changes made to the Uniform Code of Military Justice so that you don't have victims going through these what are called Section 32 hearings, where they are cross-examined for 7, 8, 9 hours a day for 3 days. Why would anyone report if they're going to be abused like that? So we've made lots of those kind of changes, but we still need to deal with getting them out of the chain of command. But I'm about to chair, knock on wood, the Subcommittee on Military Personnel in the Armed Services Committee. So I'm sure the DOD is not happy about it.
Wow. We have a lot of great questions from the audience. I want to start right now with that. What is the difference between being a victim and a survivor? Is this an internal mindset or how others see you?
I think it's all internal. I remember reading stories where they would refer to me as a victim of Guyana, and I I would cringe from it because I didn't want to spend my life being that victim. So I think it requires an internal commitment to move beyond it. It doesn't happen overnight, and it doesn't happen easily. But I do think you have to will yourself to be a survivor.
All right. Let me just, along those lines, in your opinion, are there elements of identity cultism at work in the Republican Party?
I've had that question like 4 or 5 times now.
Is it as dangerous as the Jim Jones cult?
I don't think I can go that far, but I can say that there are lots of examples where people look the other way. The Catholic Church being one, the military being another, the Congress being another. And I won't say it's Republicans. I think, we have inherent checks and balances in our system. There's 3 equal institutions, but it's designed that way, so one is a check on the other. Now, the judiciary, for the most part, has still been a check, but the Congress has just kind of lost its will. So there is, it's more complex than being a cult, but I do think that there are lots of examples where behavior is tolerated because of a church, because of someone's influence, and it has just drastic effects on people's lives.
Do you think with the new Congress things might begin to change?
Oh, I think there's going to be I think the restoration of the checks and balances will be very apparent in the House. And I think even the Senate will start to show greater independence.
Do you think the control Jones had over the 900 people was faith, political, or socially based? Is this something we have to fear in present or future American leaders?
I think he drew people to the church because it sounded like a perfect utopian kind of an environment. But then he beat them up. I mean, imagine being tormented and physically abused and sexually abused and your loyalty tested as to whether or not you are going to call out or report your spouse, your friend, because it became a very fear-based environment in which to live. And you would think, well, why didn't they just leave? Well, some did leave, but others had nowhere to go.
Weren't they signing checks? Some were signing their checks.
All the senior citizens were signing their Social Security checks over to him. Mm.
We talked about so many things that happened in your life. How did you continue after so many tragedies? What advice would you give to those given an unfair and unjust share of tragedy?
So that was, one of the ways I coped with Guyana. Everyone got their fair share of trauma in life or sadness or disappointment, and I just got mine early in life. And then when all those other things kept happening to me, I said, wait a minute, there is no fair share. You just get what you get, and your challenge is to somehow persevere, to move through it. And I don't think we appreciate how much resilience we all have. If someone had told me before any of this happened, how I would have thought that I would just have curled up and returned to the fetal position. But we're stronger than we think we are. So I talk about the 3 F's: family, friends, and faith. And that's how I have been able to get through it all.
What is your strategy for finally getting the ERA passed?
Ah,
and
a great
thank
question.
You for doing that. Yes, great questions.
So the ERA has been introduced every Congress since 1923, when Alice Paul first introduced it, after women finally got the right to vote in 1920. It is not in the Constitution. Discrimination against women is not prohibited in the Constitution. Ask, you can't anymore, but the late Antonin Scalia was once asked that question. And he says, well, if you're asking me if the Constitution requires discrimination based on sex, the answer is no. But if you're asking me, does it prohibit it based on sex, the answer is also no. So 90% of the population thinks it's already in the Constitution, and 80% thinks it should be in the Constitution. So why isn't it in the Constitution? Long storied history. 1972 gets passed by Congress, sent to the states. 35 states pass the ERA. They're three short. Comes back to Congress, and in 1982, it was extended to 1982. And there was this expectation that it would just get the next three states and pass. Well, it didn't. So it's sort of languished. So there's two bills, one by Carolyn Maloney that starts the whole process all over again. And the other one is the bill that I have, which strikes the deadline in the preamble. Now, it would certainly cause a constitutional challenge, but I think that we can make the case that it's already had the precedent by Congress having amended the date, and so striking the date should not be different. And then we need one more state, Virginia, which is poised to do it this year, next year. So I think we're very close, and I think it's going to happen certainly in the next 10 years, if not in the next 2 years.
2 years would be amazing for you.
2 years would be what our young daughters and granddaughters deserve, I think.
One of the things, and I remember seeing you on the floor, you talked about abortion and the outrage you felt when a congressman labeled the procedure as fetal murder. Tell us how you responded to that comment.
So it was late one night, and we were debating the first bill that the Republicans had introduced when they retook the House. This is 2011. And it was H.R. 1, and it was a bill to defund Planned Parenthood. And this colleague of mine was reading from a book about second trimester abortions, and he was talking about how they sawed off the legs, and I'm just recoiling from it. And I was actually intending to speak about something else, and then after he did that, the rage inside of me just erupted, and I stood up and I said, "How dare you talk about something you know nothing about? To think that a mother would cavalierly take the life of a fetus at 17 weeks is just preposterous." And I was trembling when I finished. And I was approached by Congressman John Lewis, who said that it was like one of the most powerful speeches he had heard. And then he told me this story. He remembers his aunt was staying, as he referred to his aunt, was staying with his family. And one day, his mother brought her down in a blood-stained nightgown, and she never returned. And that powerful story has stayed with me. And that was the nature of black back alley abortions back then. We just can't go back.
Are we in danger of having the...
I don't think so.
Okay.
I really don't think so. Not that we don't have to stay vigilant, but I think women have made a very strong point in the last election, and... I think hell would pay.
All right, before we run out of time, I know that there have to have been some high points for you in your career that just make you laugh out loud.
Make me laugh out loud?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
You going to share it, or are you just going to keep it to yourself?
No. Well, you know, my great love is being able to introduce legislation and have it turn into law. I mean, that gives me such a sense of satisfaction and being able to change people's lives. That was fulfilled for me a great deal at the time in the California legislature because the process works so much better than it does in Congress. One of the bills I carried was one that dealt with the issue of child support enforcement and how the feminization of poverty was occurring in part because child support orders by the court were not being enforced. So I came up with a series of bills to try and address that, one of which was to basically take away the license of anyone who was not repaying their child support. And so the bill gets signed into law, and the first person to get hit was a physician in San Diego who owed $100,000 in child support and hadn't felt compelled to pay it until he was about to lose his medical license. And then my next favorite one was a beekeeper. I always like to say we will license anything that moves in California. And so this gentleman was about to lose his beekeeper's license, and he wasn't all that concerned about losing his beekeeper's license, but he had a Harley Davidson. And once he found out they were going to put a lien on his Harley Davidson, he decided he was going to come up with a means to repay the child support that he ordered. So those were some of the fun ones that I had the pleasure of dealing with.
All right. Now, you have two great kids, and you have a husband who adores you, and you adore him. Please tell us how that first date came about.
Oh.
The fix-up.
So one of the merry widows was on a trip that my husband was on at the time, and she said, I have this great woman I'd like to introduce you to. And he says, well, who is it? And she said, Jackie Spear. So I'm not interested.
He knew who you were.
He knew where I was.
Okay, yeah.
Since I'm an introvert, I don't want anything to do with her. So this friend of mine asked him not once, not twice, but five times over the course of 3 or 4 months.
Boy, that's a lot of rejection.
Yeah, that's a lot of rejection, isn't it?
He owes
now,
you.
Now that I think about it. So finally, he says, all right, I'll call her. And so he calls me, and we had a horrible first date. Second date wasn't much better.
Oh, do tell. Come on. Give us the details. First of all, what was he wearing?
Oh, he was wearing a plaid short sleeve shirt.
Let's see. Not your type.
No, and he was a fly fisherman.
Anyway, sport.
So the beautiful part of that story was that I knew that he was the one when I was auctioning off some trips at a Crohn's and colitis nonprofit event. And we were going to go out to dinner afterwards. And he ended up buying a trip to New York. And I was embarrassed because I thought, you know, maybe he felt compelled to do it because I was the auctioneer. He says, no, I thought maybe you'd like to take the kids to New York and we could plan a trip together.
Oh, right. Mm. And yeah. Did you go on the trip?
And we did go on the trip. And it was a great trip. And then you know, eventually we tied the knot, and little Jackson walked me down the aisle, and Stephanie was one of the flower girls. Mm. And then about 3 years later, Barry adopted both the kids.
That's a real man, huh? Wow.
And I still don't fly fish.
But you like to watch him.
But I watch him, and we have a log cabin in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and you know, it's a good life. It's a very good life. Thank you all for helping to make it so.
We have a few more minutes. And one of the things that one of the many things I love about the work you do is it always helps to empower people or to enrich their lives. You have a program that I had the privilege of participating in that helps seniors. Talk about why you do that and what's involved. I mean, there are hundreds of people who show up for that.
800?
Yes.
Between 600 and 800
huge.
Every year. But it's quite an event. And the event was just last month. The day after the event, they start calling, wanting to reserve for the next year. But It's something I did to honor my grandmother after she passed away. And I've done it now for 31 years. And it's done in conjunction with my colleagues on the Board of Supervisors and in the state legislature now. And it's a, you know, four-hour, five-hour conference. We feed them breakfast and lunch, and we talk about issues that are of interest to them. And there's an advisory committee that helps with it every year. And there's always, you know, great information on healthcare and good living and technology and whatever the issues are that are of most interest to the senior community.
You said this was a tribute to your grandmother. Were there issues with her in her life?
No, I just, after she passed away, I just decided I wanted to do something for seniors. And so that's how that started.
You also have a magnificent conference that thousands of people turn out for. It's called the Professional Businesswomen of California. And I don't know how many of you have been to that or if you have an opportunity, but 6,000 people turn out for that, women and men. It's extraordinary.
It's spun off as a nonprofit. It's been around now for 30 years as well. And it's a great place for women to invest in their future through networking and professional development. And we've had incredible speakers over the decades now. And Cheryl Jennings is always one of the MCs of the event.
I guess that means I have to go next year,
yes,
right?
Yes, you do.
No, it's worthwhile. I try to always sponsor someone myself. As a woman who had been a single mom with two kids trying to work, you can completely relate to what it's like for so many women out there. Because legislators, and I know back in the day there wasn't much money in it, and you were trying to avoid bankruptcy at one point.
How did I do it?
Yes.
You know, we sometimes forget the fact that Social Security is not just for seniors. There's also Social Security for widows and children. So I was saved, literally, by the fact that my kids each got a check every month from the Social Security Administration after my husband died, and that helped pay for the child care that they needed. So it's not just a senior program. It's not just a retirement program. It's actually a life-saving program for lots of other people.
That's a good safety net that I'm sure you want to protect. Mm-hmm. We have some more questions from the audience here. We have about 4 minutes left. As a gunshot survivor, do you the remaining bullets trigger any alarms in you emotionally? What do you see of your chances? Second question, what do you see as a chance of increasing firearm violence? And
prevention.
What to do about, let's see, I'm trying to read this, restoring assault weapon ban. So it's three questions in there.
So you never, ever fully recover from gun violence. And I keep thinking of the 500-plus people in Las Vegas who were shot but survived. I mean, the people that die, obviously, it's a horrific experience for their families, and obviously their lives are lost. But those who are wounded carry scars, physical and emotional, the rest of their lives. So to diminish the incidents like that would make a lot of sense. So that's why gun violence prevention is so important, why we need to close loopholes, restore the assault weapon ban, prevent kids from buying guns under the age of 21, banning bump stocks and high-capacity magazines. Most of those laws, with the exception of buying guns under the age of 21, most of those laws are already in effect in California, and yet look what has happened a number of times. Children now in this country, their number one fear is safety in the classroom. When you think that our flags are at half-mast almost all the time now because of one mass shooting after another. So there's many things we need to put into place. Gun locks that really work, that are, you know, smart tech, that have a thumbprint so that a small kid can't pick it up and shoot himself or others, mm-hmm. or that someone could use a gun who is not intended to have the gun. I think it's all going to change now. I actually am feeling that we are turning the corner on this issue. And believe me, when you get rid of all the baby boomers in Congress and replace them with millennials and Gen Xers, they get it.
You're not talking about taking guns away. You're talking about making it harder for people who shouldn't have guns.
Right.
Okay.
No, but I'm just saying this issue that we can't seem to deal with in Congress is one that I think will be dealt with much more quickly when the younger generations start to populate Congress. But I think we're going to get some measures certainly through the House and maybe even through the Senate. I mean, look what the Parkland kids did. In 3 weeks in Florida, which was a very big NRA state, they got a ban on bump stocks, a 3-day waiting period, and you couldn't purchase guns if you were under 21.
That's the younger generation. The one final question from the audience. You're talking about the new Congress. The new House members do have a steep learning curve. Well, they're inexperienced. They have a lot of inexperience. So how can you and others help them become good legislators?
So, good question. They don't think that they they need all that on-the-job training, which is kind of fun to watch because, you know, shaking up the institution wouldn't be a bad thing. So they go through 2 weeks of orientation. They're going to spend next week, or this week, I should say, in Harvard learning about public policy. And then they're going to be in a situation where they're members of caucuses, whether it's the Blue Dogs or the New Dems or the Progressives, that will be filled with more senior members that will become, I think, their mentors. And we will have a Democratic Women's Caucus that will be flush with new women that we're going to take them on the road, because I think it's pretty remarkable that so many of them have gotten elected, and I want to showcase them that, you know, you can do it too. So
you're going to bring them out here?
I am, yes.
All right. I think that's a good way to end this program. Thank you, Congressman.
Thank you, Cheryl. Dear. Thank you, everybody.
All right, I have to do one final piece of business here. I want to get my gavel again. I want to thank Jackie Speer, the U.S. Representative for California's District 14 and author of the new memoir, Undaunted, Surviving Jonestown, Summoning Courage and Fighting Back. We also want to thank everybody here, as well as our audience on radio and television and the internet. My name is Cheryl Jennings, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club and the place where you're in the know is adjourned.